Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
There we go. That was the voice of Brian Brown, of course, our dearly departed founder. A wonderful man. I can't hear his voice without missing him. There you go. Irreplaceable and irrepressible when he was with us. He may still be. This is the Brown Briefly, and it is... Oh, goodness. July the 14th. Holy cow.
Bastille Day.
For those of you who are interested in beginning any uprisings, this might be a fortuitous date to do so.
Oh, good idea.
in a personal aside, my parents met on this day in 1946.
Wow.
There you go. Quite a... And I'm glad they did, because otherwise I might still be here, but I would be in a vastly different form. If that makes any sense.
Huh. That's an interesting biological question.
Got us all scratching our heads.
That's
on
right.
That one, Michael.
So they started their own revolution called the Michael Revolution.
Right. Yeah. No, they just met that day.
Yeah, I'm willing to argue it that way. Sure. Why not? Oh, at the controls, at the helm of the radio station down there at the beautiful Gene Bosch studio is our master of the zany ziggurat of Zoom, the late of the Texas and Montana plains, Truman O'Brien.
Whoa, boy, hey, boy, these introductions are getting better all the time.
They are.
Thanks, Michael.
Yeah, well, sure.
Now I always have to make all the rest of us feel that good.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, I can't, you know, because it just fell together for Truman. Ziggurat came to mind.
Ziggurat. All right.
Yeah. Yeah, so there you go. Our guardian of the universe and guardian of the galaxy. I think the universe covers the galaxy as well. So.
Right. That's yes. Right. My role is expanding here.
Well, it's got to. Just as the universe expands, so does your role.
There you go.
And we need that in these times. It's our wonderful retired sort of professor of history who stays very busy with all kinds of really cool projects with our history museum here on the island, for which I am very grateful. And I know many others too. Mr. Bruce Hallman.
Great. Thank you. Hey. Welcome. Good to be here.
Hey, and Bruce, can you give us a quick recap of the weekend, how that went, or were you involved or on the recording?
Yeah, what Truman's referring to is back at the beginning of this, we started what we're calling the Vachon COVID-19 Archive Project. So we've been collecting photographs, artifacts. We've been doing interviews. Mostly up to this point, we've done about 50 interviews with people who are on the front lines of the COVID response here on Vachon. And then two weekends ago in Burton and last weekend at Thriftway, we did sort of person on the street interviews with people to tell their COVID stories. And we had just some amazing stories. A young woman that I interviewed is a sort of an independent reporter who had been working with the Kurds and was embedded with American troops in northern Iraq. Wow. And now can't go back.
Wow.
She's working at Thriftway. She's living on Vachon. She's had her byline in major newspapers and major publications.
Wow.
And had two stories about people whose wedding plans were either accelerated or put off by the COVID pandemic. So, I mean, just fascinating sort of everyday life stories. We've collected 25 of those already. We'll be at Thriftway on this Friday and Saturday, and then we'll be at IGA on Sunday. This is a project in combination with Voice of Vashon, the Heritage Museum, and Vashon Be Prepared. So we're trying to collect sort of the stories of what's going on right now in everyday life on Vashon with this pandemic. So it's been exciting stuff.
And the times are what, 10 to 3? Is that correct?
10 to 3 on Saturday, Friday and Saturday, and 12 to 3 on Sunday at IVA. Great.
Encourage folks to come out and share your story. That's great. Thanks, Bruce. Yeah.
Thank you, Truman.
Wow, it's wonderful. Living history as it's all unfolding, and my goodness, you never know who you're going to meet on this island. But I'm struck by that woman's courage. That's really? Quite that's quite a job for any journalist being out there. Man, you're out there. Bruce, have the stories, can you, I know it's early and I don't know if you've had time to look at each and every one of them, but is there a kind of, do you see anything emerging from the stories? I mean, personal struggles or personal triumphs or funny anecdotes or?
I think the one common thread that has come through in virtually every interview, and I've done probably half of them, we've had other historians doing other ones, but the one thing that comes through just indelibly in every single interview is, one, how thankful people are that they're on Vashon. Vashon's a great place to be right now in the middle of this pandemic. And number two, everybody has spoken about how impressed they are with the way the community has stepped up to respond to this crisis and this pandemic. And just the range, and virtually everybody talks about this, the range of expertise and experience and abilities that are on this island that have just come out of the woodwork. I mean, these people have been our friends and neighbors that we haven't known for years. And this crisis occurs, and all of a sudden, epidemiologists, retired folks working in medicine. I mean, the Medical Reserve Corps, which is running the testing and running the tracing on Vashon, went from about 15 people to over 100 people in a matter of a month. People stepped up,
and it's
across the board.
And it's currently a national model, we're doing.
Right. Yeah. And not only, just on every level, the Medical Reserve Corps, been featured in the New York Times, MSNBC, but also the way the Emergency Operations Center has functioned. We are one of the few communities that have built under the Medical Reserve Corps a very substantial community care section. So for the psychological and mental health of the community, they've built just a tremendous sort of response network to that. So it's not just, they don't see it, and I don't see it as just a medical emergency. I mean, it's a pandemic, but it also has social, political, and economic ramifications. I mean, I'm talking a lot, and I apologize, but one of the things that just blows me away is the Vashon Be Prepared has created a fund to help businesses and individuals. They've raised over $230,000 in the first couple months, as a reserve to help businesses, to help people who are unemployed. They've got people working with individuals to help them through the unemployment paperwork. I mean, it's just a broad range across the board effort. And there's probably 150 people involved, substantially involved in making it work. And it's just incredible. So those are the things that have popped out in all of these interviews. Just number one, Vashon's a great place to be right now. And number two, Vashon as a community has stepped up, neighbors helping neighbors in just phenomenal ways.
Thank you, Bruce.
That's fascinating to me, and it makes me think about how I read so much about the pandemic having exposed the weaknesses in our federal government, and here we're looking at Vashon, and this pandemic has exposed the foundation of our deep sense of community here, and that's something that's always impressed me, the deep sense of community, how we care for one another, and how many accomplished and experienced people there are here on this island. We're really lucky.
Yeah.
Indeed. And that voice that you just heard, I'm sure our listener recognizes the voice of Susan McCabe, our thespian occasionally, not as much as she used to be, but her time is filled with managing all sorts of things and doing her radio show. And I'm having one of those blanks.
Real talk.
I'm thinking Sounds Alive came to my mind.
Well, that's good. I like
that's
that.
Good. That's good.
I'm going to be 66 in a week. You know,
no sympathy here, sir.
Yeah, we don't want to hear it, be perfectly honest, Michael.
Anyway, Susan McCabe, wonderful human being and journalist. Thank you.
Happy to be here.
And who's coming up?
Oh, a couple of amazing island accomplished people, filmmakers, Michael Monteleone and Dennis Lambert, who have finished, I believe it is the sixth in their series of Vashon Then and Now programs. And this is the second in their, I guess I'd call it a series, the Japanese experience on Vashon Island. So they're going to tell us all about that.
Great.
That sounds cool. That's great. Boy, that's a rich part of the history of the Northwest, and one I've always been fascinated by because I've had a sort of a peripheral reach to it. My days of berry picking for the Nishimura family and the numerous other berry fields that used to exist in Puyallup and Sumner Valleys, I think even the Ording Valley a little bit, but those are sadly mostly gone now. There's a few left. Last but not least, we have the indefatigable, irrepressible as well, Kevin Jones, who is indivisible and indivisible Vashon's political liaison, master of all things that have to do with getting people to get off their duffs and vote and be active. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you. We have the anti-duff campaign in full swing at the moment. I'm just curious how many of our listeners did Google a ziggurat to find out that it is indeed a tower from ancient times. I did not know that myself. So thanks so much for bringing that to my attention.
Thank you for checking it out, Kevin.
Just mentioned that Indivisible Vashon this Thursday has our inaugural opening of the Resistance Cafe. And it looks like we're going to be doing a Resistance Cafe once a week on Thursdays at 3. The cafe may expand. Right now we just have the 2 hours a week option. But you can drop in and do phone banking, texting, writing postcards. Kevin@indivisiblevashon.org. If you want an invitation, we'll make sure you get one. And so we'll try this out and see how it goes. It's a fun, frolicking, anti-duffing, and getting the vote out.
So this is a virtual cafe, correct?
It is a virtual cafe. We're Zooming together, and we'll have a breakout room for doing technical training on how to do texting or phone banking, and then just the bar where you can just do your thing and chat. We're going to try it out. Try it out for size. Should be fun.
It's a really cool idea, Kevin. Thank you.
An excellent idea. Yeah. We can't, I think those of us who are progressives or I'm just going to go ahead and say patriots. Patriotism can take a number of different forms. And I know many, many people, that I know, some folks might say, oh, they're not really patriots because of something else. But I think it was Jefferson who said that dissent is the truest form of patriotism, something along those lines. And it's time for people of good faith, good conscience, and good patriotism to really work hard to set the ship of state on a new course, to say the least.
Kind of reminds me of the statement that the best customer you have is the customer who complains.
That's right.
Because otherwise you would never know that you have something to address.
Yeah. Susan, what's it?
Well, that reminds me of a quote I recently read from Congressman John Lewis, who has all his life been a patriot, a dissenter, who said his greatest fear is that he would wake up one morning and our democracy would be gone. That's what
we're... It's an unnerving prospect.
It is.
I didn't have time today to forward it to you folks, to the rest of the brieflies, but I subscribed to the National Review's daily updates because I thought I want to get some perspectives here from what the National Review is thinking about events. And that's been fascinating in itself and very worthwhile. But there was a commentary, a rather long essay today that I will get around to the rest of the brieflies about what the writer sort of cheekily called the Venezuelization of the United States. And it was quite a blistering condemnation of the hypocrisy that he sees being acted out in the ranks of the Republican Party and if people think that our government can't turn in a very bad direction, they haven't been paying attention for the last 3.5 years. Kevin?
You know, to that point, there's a colleague of mine whose family roots go to Argentina, and the language used when that government was overthrown, being did in the language we're hearing.
Oh, you're breaking up. You're breaking up, Kevin.
We lost you.
It is chilling to the core to hear the same rhetoric being used that was the preamble to their loss of their democracy in Argentina.
Can you give us some examples, Kevin?
I do not actually have the exact words. And this person could tell them if they were here, they would share them. But unfortunately, they did not stay in my mind. But I think it's just the general theme that what we're seeing is what's called dog whistles, or to some whistles, and to some are blaring sirens. And you mentioned, Susan, the loss of democracy and the threats that we're under right now. And I think they're very real. You know, we've got probably some examples we're going to talk about in the show today.
Yeah.
Well, Kevin, you had, speaking of examples of different things, there were some topics you did not get to last week that we as a group did not get to. And perhaps we could pick up on one of those.
Well, and there are a couple. The thing that I think is more timely right now, but is related, is the recent Supreme Court decisions now about whether or not the president is above the law. And the challenge in my mind is that the day after, literally within 24 hours of the Supreme Court saying no, the president does have to respond to subpoenas. There is congressional oversight. We haven't given up on that idea. Then is the commutation of Roger Stone's sentence, as well as the removal of his fine, which prompted at least one Republican in Utah, Senator Romney, to say, quote, unprecedented historic corruption, unquote. So here we are with, the tools of democracy being used in a subversive way, which is exactly what the people who wrote How Democracies Die, this is how it happens. And we are now seeing those things happen, and it's disturbing.
That would be an understatement.
Yeah. This was some of what that writer in the National Review was talking about, not directly addressing that because the essay was written before all this unfolded and then printed out. But it makes me think of Senator Orrin Hatch, who has represented Utah as a senator now for at least 30 years, I think longer than that, going back to the Reagan administration. And he's one of those people that is so frustrating to me because I think to myself, where is his voice? This is a person who's I think done some good things for the country. I don't agree with a lot of the things that he voted on and that he introduced. But he has represented Utah. The population there has returned him again and again to the Senate by pretty good margins. So that's who he has to represent. And yet, where is his voice on these sorts of things? Where are the voices of any of the other Republicans?
The only ones I can see who are making any sort of statement are doing it simply in their silence, by backing off. Susan Collins comes to mind first, but people who are just sort of dropping out of view instead of actually standing up. Mitt Romney is the only Republican I've seen stand up to the corruption that this administration is practicing. Go ahead, Kevin. Kevin?
Yes. And oh, by the way, speaking of Susan Collins, there is a primary election today in Maine. And I have chosen to join the Mainers as they gather at it's like 4:30 our time, so 7:30 their time, to look at the polls and see who's ahead and so on and so on. So it should be a good time with my newfound buddies in Maine to see who Susan Collins will face in November.
Do you know any of the primary candidates, Kevin? Are you aware of any of them? And
let's see. I would have to look it up. It's not Teresa Greenfield because that's Iowa. Amy McGrath is in Kentucky. I know the name. It'll come up. It'll come to mind in a minute. So, hey, one of the other things that comes to mind, you know, the silence, the deafening silence of the conservatives who are really held, you know, bound to Trump because his approval ratings are still high amongst Republicans. 538 shows his approval is now dropping again. It's about 40% right now. The low of his tenure has been about 36. So there's still some floor. But here's the thing. You know, we hear these concerns that, you know, Trump says, oh, look, Xi is president for life in China. And guess what? Putin just got, you know, they're what, 18 years or something as president of Russia. Trump really loves that idea. So I think that we need a mandate on November 3rd. We need a huge outpouring of people to certainly vote with your heart, vote with your head. But I think about voting to say we don't accept this kind of leadership in our country. A mandate will help us move forward. And some claim that in Washington state, you know, the state's going to vote blue, vote your conscience, don't worry about it. Well, that sort of is one way of thinking about it. The other way of thinking about it is we can use our vote to say no to the kind of leadership that is really disturbing that we're seeing now. So lots of considerations, but I think we need to make sure to kick the current occupant of the White House out pretty hard. And this is our time to do it.
With all his buddies.
All the silent Republicans would well, potentially do. A lot of them would.
You know, not all Republicans are silent. You know, I mean, it's important to note the important Republican groups, the log cabin Republicans. You know, there's three or four Republican groups that have come out very, very substantially against Trump and running ads and running campaigns. You know, what's disturbing is that the political office holders who are Republican are the ones who are tending to be silent, mm-hmm. whereas those who are true patriots who are Republicans are speaking out. And so it's really an interesting thing to watch in these primaries. And I think these primaries will start to give us some indication. But whether or not the public is just going to boot most of those silent Republicans out in this next general election in November. And I wouldn't be surprised to see just a blue tsunami sweep through even the red states, particularly as this pandemic gets much worse.
So,
Kevin.
Go ahead, Kevin. I got one thing to throw out here.
Well, that is certainly the why I'm talking about Maine and Susan Collins and Iowa and Tom Tillis and North Carolina. to make that difference. And the numbers look really good. The numbers are always questionable about whether polling, you know, really tells us the truth. But the trends are also good. So we can't let our foot off the accelerator. We need to keep doing the work. But I'm optimistic.
I just found the folks who are running against or running for the Democratic primary in Maine. Maine House Speaker Sarah Gideon, who is the favorite in terms of visibility, money, and backing of the D.C.-based campaign machine. But she's headed into a ranked choice primary against two more progressive Democratic candidates, lobbyist Betsy Sweet and attorney Bree Kidman. So those are the three who are running for the primary today in Maine. Go ahead.
And one of them will get something on the order of $10 million that was donated during the time of the Kavanaugh hearings, when the appeal was, if you don't want Susan, if you would hate for Susan Collins to support Kavanaugh, then donate. And if she does, we will keep your money and give it to the winner of the primary. So that should be disclosed here within a week or so.
10 million. Wow.
Jeez Louise.
It sounds like a lot, but boy, what does it take in a state election to win financially? Do we have any averages on that?
No. Everybody's blank.
I want to say like 30 to 40 million, but I don't really know.
30 to 40 million in a statewide election.
Wow.
That's ridiculous.
So I wanted to throw something out. The tweet that Trump forwarded, I'm trying to find the guy's name, Woolsey, whatever his name is, the guy that's the
game show.
Game show guy. What's his name? Worley?
Chuck Woolery?
Anyway, I couldn't find it. But anyway, it... I have to tell you what's interesting. Of course, on Facebook, I have lots of super, super conservative right-wing folks that are friends, relatives, whatever that I see. And they honestly believe this pandemic is all a big conspiracy to get rid of Trump. They honestly, truly believe it. And that tweet that he forwarded from that game show doofus, they absolutely take it's gospel. That's really the way it is.
Well, it may be.
Yeah, it could be
Mother Nature's way of sort of readjusting.
But it astounds me that they could think that there is a conspiracy that would be that large and that far reaching that somebody other than some kook is going to point out. I mean, it's astounding to me. How can that be?
Yeah, we never put a man on the moon either.
Yeah, exactly.
Right there. I mean, right.
Well, this is part of I love quotes, and I'm reminded again of the quote: "He that troubleth his own house shall inherit the wind." And this started again. Go back to 1980 and the 1979 and the presidential campaign of Reagan. And him just pounding that theme over and over again, government is not the solution. Government is the problem. And when you have that for 40 years and you have the party, the GOP, far too many of their people being quite happy to go along with that because it was a winning formula. Well, now we've got a situation where there's this immense distrust on the part of many people in the country who just feel they cannot trust the government. It's the dark state or the deep state, all those things. And so now at a spot when we desperately need leadership at a national level, this is what outrages me almost to the point of, if I had any hair left, I would tear it out. Thousands of people have died needlessly, and I don't say that casually. The federal government's response to this has been so badly bungled, so corrupt. Jared Kushner is appointed part of the task force to address this, and immediately pushed to the side people who actually knew what to do in an emergency like this, and brought in buddies who were former hedge fund managers. Great. You know, and because of this, thousands of people have died needlessly. Thousands more are sick. And now we're in the throes of another wave of this that is at least as bad as it was back in April.
And if you did you hear the head of the CDC, the head of the WHO made a profound statement today saying, look, folks, this is a worldwide problem and we need to have a worldwide solution. Mm-hmm. And there has to be some plan, worldwide plan, to make this thing work. And these little individual efforts all around the world are not going to do anything. And especially when you've got a country the size of the U.S., it's not playing. Mm-hmm. It wants to throw out the WHO, for crying out loud.
Kevin,
You know, Michael, you mentioned this disinformation campaign and the repeated lies, and eventually, you know, it just becomes part of the vernacular and people buy into it. I've actually, in the last 72 hours, 24 hours, been involved with two disinformation campaign discussions. One of them was headed up by a fellow from UW, and the other one was on television last night. And one of the facts that came out of the thing on TV was they said that one of the things they did was they would show people headlines. So you got a group of people and you show them like six headlines, and they ask them, you know, do you believe which ones do you believe are true? And you kind of rank them. Then they go off to something else. And then they come back and they show like 20 headlines. The original six were also in the list of 20. And what happened on the second reviewing is those six items went from like 14% belief as being true to 24% as believing that they were true, just by the simple act of repetition. Yeah. So it is, scientists say, yes, the things that you hear the president repeating over and over and over again, that's happening because it works and we're falling for it. And, you know, we just need to be aware of these campaigns that are out.
It is an old marketing axiom that says people need to hear something positive 11 times from 11 trusted sources and they'll believe it. If you want to convince people of something negative, 8 times they'll do it.
Wow. 8 to so fewer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's the old, the truth is still tying its shoes and the lies halfway around the world. My goodness.
That's a good one.
Yeah. 20, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Michael, if I can take you back to your Inherit the Wind quote, that goes back to the play by that name that was about the Scopes trial in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. A lot of cultural and religious historians look at the Scopes trial as really the turning point that has led us to where we are today in terms of the emergence of a conservative fundamentalist religious right in the United States. That they gained dominance in the 1920s as a result of the Scopes trial, but the Great Depression and the New Deal sort of swept that away, and into the 1970s, and then Reagan sort of re-erected it, and what we're seeing today is 100 years of a religious right-wing sort of not conspiracy, but effort to view the government as the problem, because the government essentially is what ruled against. It was the law that ruled against Scopes. Well, found him guilty, but basically fined him a dollar. So in a sense, sort of enshrined evolutionary teaching in the schools, in what are now called government schools, not public schools. And that's an important sort of terminology shift, going back to what Susan was saying. You know, if you can get people to start thinking of what we call public schools as government schools, then all of a sudden they become part of the problem rather than part of the solution. Mm-hmm. So it's very deep, sort of embedded in American culture and American intellectual thought, particularly in terms of relationship between church and state. And the Scopes trial was one of those turning points.
So what you're saying, Bruce, is that the Scopes trial allowed the greater influence of church on state?
No, it actually, the actual outcome of the trial was viewed as sort of of enshrining evolutionary teaching in the schools that up to that point, you know, in Tennessee, it was illegal to teach evolution. Well, the trial basically, even though Scopes was found guilty, it basically overturned that precedent and so allowed evolution to enter into the public school systems. What that did is it engendered a response by the conservative religious right to oppose that. And what we've seen is 100 years of that effort by the religious right to gain dominance in American political thought. And that's what you're seeing right now with Betty DeVos and with this sort of a sense of getting rid of government schools and replacing them with charter schools. So it's a 100-year campaign that we've seen working.
Wow, that is fascinating. And so that move by Betsy DeVos, in my view, and in Heather Cox Richardson's view, is another step in privatizing government, another step in that conservative campaign to privatize everything about government and take away its funding and therefore its power. Mm-hmm. And put it all in the hands of actually the 1%.
Right.
And would you want to explain the logic on or the strategy that has been exposed in that article? I'm not sure that we've portrayed that for our listener so that they see that relationship.
Well, Betsy DeVos is threatening to defund schools that public schools that do not open in person in the fall, and to divert those funds to private schools that will open in person, which is another way of taking money from the public coffers for education, of course, and putting it in the hands of the wealthy who can afford to send their kids to private schools. So that's the strategy for the school funding. Is that enough for you, Kevin, or do you want that to go farther?
Well, yeah, and thanks for going there. And the use of the pandemic, right, as the excuse or the condition. And then the rhetoric that we're hearing that seems just ludicrous to so many of us and hopefully to so many parents that, oh, we're going to send your kids to school because, you know, they'll probably survive if they get the virus, you know, cross your fingers, we sure hope. And then when they have their birthday party, you know, with the family, you know, hopefully nobody is actually going to catch the virus. So it just seems really crazy. And why would anybody go there? But I think that observation provides a motive, right? Other than the other motive, which is clearly, you know, get your kids in school so you can go back to work and my job numbers go up. And I can get reelected. And oh, I'm sorry, you know, if you have more fatalities in your family, geez, should have gotten some better health care, I guess. It's just so crazy. But now we see maybe some linkages.
Yeah. And I recently heard on NPR that the people who are catching the virus, the spike is happening among people 20 to 40 thereabouts, and that they are getting sicker. They're requiring more oxygen and more care. And I'm not sure I can confirm this, but a new strain of the virus is 10 times more contagious than the original strain. So we're not dealing with just one virus at this point. We're dealing with a mutating virus. And I guess that's a conspiracy formed by the virus itself.
Right. Yeah.
But also, and it goes along with another piece of information where, and I don't know how many examples there are, but one physician, at least I think he's on the East Coast, said he has a patient who has contracted the virus now twice. And there was, you know, tested positive, went through the symptoms, felt better, two negative tests, so the absence of virus, followed by then another positive test and symptoms that were even worse than the first go around. So again, there's so much we don't know. And right. These are the things, if you're a risk manager, recommending we all have our kids to go back to school is probably not the first thing you want to recommend.
That would be called
Bruce,
nuts.
Well, I was just going to cycle back to what Susan was talking about. This whole idea of opening up schools, it's part of that effort to shift away from public education to private education. And it's exactly the same thing we saw in the 1950s and 1960s in the South with Brown versus the Board of Education. What happened is you had massive movements of whites out of public schools into private schools, either religious schools or denominational schools or privately funded schools, which left the public schools, impoverished. And so what you had throughout the South were failing schools, public school systems, because most of the money had moved out into private school systems. It's exactly the same thing that DeVos is trying to do, using the pandemic as a way to move wealthy people out of what she's calling government schools into charter schools and private schools, and in a sense, impoverish public schools. And it's insidious, and it's just basically wrong, and it's something that we should all fight against.
This is a kind of a classic maneuver that's been perfected, and I know Naomi Klein wrote that book, I think it was Crisis Capitalism, and detailing this, how you starve an agency like FEMA or the U.S. Postal Service or any number of other agencies, public schools. Funding for public schools has been dropping precipitously over the last decades. And then when something like this happens, there's the opportunity to say, well, look at how badly that government school or that government agency or that government this, well, they can't manage it. We better turn this over to a private company and they can do it. And of course, it's like just start printing your own money.
But one of the things that gives me great hope is when you look at the history of pandemics and you look at the social revolutions that emerge out of pandemics, when you look at the Black Death and the sort of, there were three big major sort of episodes of the Black Death in Europe. What emerged was the collapse of the Dark Ages and the emergence of the Renaissance. The collapse of a system of a culture based on faith and the emergence of a culture based on reason. It's painful and it's traumatic and it's revolutionary, but it gives me great hope that this pandemic will have similar kind of social, political, and environmental consequences, mm-hmm. not only for the United States, but for the world.
As in positive consequences.
Very positive consequences.
Yeah. Well, I love that. To have that context, as I have often said before, to have that context, and it puts a different spin on things. And now I feel like, wow, okay, I'm living through revolutionary times. I'm living through really historical times. How can I be a productive force, or, however small my little part is, to help this move forward for people's betterment? That's very inspiring.
That's one very thing you can do.
That's why he's
out.
The guardian of the galaxy.
That's right. Okay, yes, folks. Right. Hey, I hate to tell you, but we are there. Thanks, everyone. See you next week.
Adios to our listener.